Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Our panel are here. Dr. Merne Lynch, Senior Research Officer with the ESRI, Professor Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College Dublin, Alison O'Connor, Sunday Times columnist, and Dan Mulhall, former Irish Ambassador to the United States. Good morning, everyone. We'll come to the newspapers presently, but obviously first we're going to go to Australia. That shocking news coming out of Bondi Beach, 10 dead in that shooting. And this is, of course, very, very close to home for us, and close to home for so many young Irish people, and indeed for families all over the country. So Melissa McKay is a presenter and reporter with ABC News Australia, and she is at the scene. Melissa, good morning.
Hi there. I'm so sorry if it's a bit loud down here. The wind is extraordinary here at Bondi Beach. Thanks for having me.
Okay, that's okay. Melissa, what can you tell us?
We are just getting a press conference right now from authorities who have just updated us to say that 12 people have been killed in the shooting here at Bondi Beach. One of the offenders has also been killed, and another is in custody. Police and the government authorities are saying that this was a targeted attack on the Jewish community. We know that there was a massive gathering happening at Bondi Beach this afternoon where those 12 people have been killed.
Okay. Oh my God. And what is the feeling in Sydney right now, Melissa?
Oh, it's absolutely heartbreaking. This is a shocking thing to have happened. You know, shootings are extraordinarily rare here in Australia, and for a targeted attack like this to take place at Bondi Beach, such an iconic, beautiful part of our city. It's just horrifying. You know, the people that I've seen and spoken to down here this evening who witnessed the attack or who live nearby just cannot believe that this has taken place. I think it's going to take quite some time for people to wrap their head around the fact that this has happened. It's you know, just hard to put into words the feeling in Sydney tonight.
Yeah. What are politicians saying?
We are just hearing from them now. There's a press conference happening in the city, so about sort of 20 minutes away from where I am now. The police and the Premier are giving an update. So I'm just checking our live blog now to check in with what is being said. And so the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, has said that this attack was designed to target Sydney's Jewish community. He said that on the first day of Hanukkah, which should have been a night of peace and joy celebrated in the community with families and supporters, has been shattered by a horrifying, evil attack. The Premier has gone on to say that our heart bleeds for Australia's Jewish community tonight, that he can only imagine the pain that they're feeling right now to see their loved ones killed as they celebrate this ancient holiday. He said it's a responsibility of all Australians to wrap their arms around our Jewish community and to help them get through this incredibly difficult period. So those comments are coming in now from the New South Wales.
And Melissa, do you know, is there a large Jewish community in Sydney or in particular areas of Sydney?
There is, yes, particularly in the eastern suburbs where we are here tonight. And the eastern suburbs of Sydney over the last few years have seen a handful of targeted attacks on the Jewish community, none quite like this, though. You know, there have been incidents of, you know, really scary graffiti attacks and such in the eastern suburbs over the last few years. But for a shooting like this to take place, for a deadly attack here in the eastern suburbs, is truly, truly terrifying for the community here. But yes, the eastern suburbs of Sydney does have quite a significant Jewish population.
Okay, for people who are just zoning in here and tuning into this, we're talking to Melissa McKay, who's at Bondi Beach, where Australian police have confirmed 12 dead and that it is a terrorist incident. And Melissa, we believe one child at least dead, yes?
In terms of exactly the identities of the people who have died, we don't know for sure. And okay, I will just clarify, police haven't yet called this a terrorist incident, but they have said it is a targeted attack on the Jewish community. But yes, 12 people dead. And yes, you know, this was a gathering of families, and there were a lot of young people in and around the area. I know myself, even this afternoon, arriving on the scene, did see a fair few young people who had witnessed and had been there at the time of this attack. So truly, truly horrifying incident for families and the Jewish community here in Sydney.
Okay, Melissa McKay of ABC News in Australia, thank you very much. Blonidney Coffig in Sydney, good morning to you.
Good evening here, but yeah, good morning there.
Yeah.
It's been a weird last 3-4 hours has been a bit strange, to say the least.
How did the news start coming through, Bronwyn?
Basically, myself and my daughter were out for something to eat. She's 29. She lives here in Sydney. She works here, and she started getting texts. Where are you? Are you guys on Bondi? Because we were there yesterday. We walked from Coogee to Bondi Beach yesterday, which is a 2-hour walk, which was amazing. It's summer here. Where are you? Are you okay? Because they know we're here. Their family are with Sheila. So they were obviously thinking, obvious place for tourists to go is Bondi. We just weren't there today. Went to another beach today. Decided to go to a less busy beach today. We're planning to go tomorrow, which we won't be doing now, obviously. She just started getting messages. Where are you? Where are you guys? Are you okay? And one of her bosses at work rang her as well, who's on maternity leave at the moment, just worried about her. She just, the messages, I mean, one friend had just left the beach. The other friend was kind of locked in a bar there on Bondi until it was safe for her to leave. I presume she's out by now. I hope she is. Then messages from Irish pals on their way home to Dublin for Christmas, you know, on the stopover in Abu Dhabi or Doha, saying, are you guys okay? Everything all right? So there's a lot of messages, a lot of mayhem. Two young Irish guys were with us for dinner, Cork guy, Westmeath guy, and everyone knows somebody living near Bondi or on Bondi. I mean, she's kind of obviously upset this evening, and it just so happens coincidentally that I'm here. But it was weird because then, you know, we saw a lot of police cars, but then, you know, it's a busy city. I didn't think much of it. It's a big city. And then I just thought my son was back in her place on his own. I said, let's go back. Just at least we're together and we're fine. We're absolutely fine. Everyone around us is fine. But we're 15 minutes from Bondi. It's a bit weird. It's a bit weird. You know, for people of a certain age, you think of 9/11, you think of other stuff like that. I even thought of the Oma bombing. I don't know if Sheila was 2 or 3 when that happened. And I thought of that again this evening, which was weird. But, you know, those kind of sense of urgencies and messages looking for, you know, paramedics and that kind of thing. So,
we know this, but just given you're there and in the area and have been there, there's a huge concentration of young Irish people in that area particularly, isn't there?
Brendan, massive. Like, walking on the beach yesterday, Sheila met a friend of hers who's teaching over here, an Irish girl. They're everywhere. Like, you know, you're coming out of coffee shops and they're saying Niamh, order for Niamh, Cléan, or Siobhan, all Irish names. It's all 25 to 32, 33-year-olds working here. It's like some of them are going home for Christmas, some of them aren't. They'll go home next year, or they hope their parents might come and see them next year. There's so many Irish people here. The Irish accents are everywhere here. You know, it's like New York back in the day for our generation, but there's so many Irish here. And they all have a good network, you know. They're all on WhatsApp. They're all messaging each other and they're all looking out for each other. And it's an incredible network, because when they move into any accommodation here, you know, someone is selling a bed, someone's selling a couch, you know, They're close. They're very close. I think like any of the Irish that go abroad, they stay close. But they look out for each other. You know, they really look out for each other.
And I'd say they're all looking after each other. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Blána Ní Coifig, mind yourself and thank you very much.
I will indeed. And thank you. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks, Blána. Okay, back to our panel here in studio, Dr. Muireann Lynch, Professor Luke O'Neill, Alison O'Connor and Dan Mulhall. Alison.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can hear in Blána's voice the shock of actually being there. And when I first heard this morning, I know now that the police have confirmed that it was targeted on the Jewish community. And you just think it's for Jewish people all over the world. The shock of that, how appalling it must be. You think of the attack in the Manchester synagogue only in October when there was two people killed. And I'm remembering a long time ago, I spent time in Australia and spent a Christmas day on Bondi. And, you know, it wasn't that much different then in terms of what Blána was saying. All of the so many young Irish people there then on the beach living there. And I was thinking of all the parents of those kids who were over there, Irish people this morning, and the worry that they would have. And I suppose we've always had this notion that Australia is very gun safe. They had a massacre in Tasmania in 1996 and 35 people were killed and they had a huge amnesty after that. But I do remember reading recently that the numbers were going back up, you know, that the numbers of guns in that society were going back up. So, I mean, it just really, it is the notion that it was linked, you know, to a Hanukkah celebration and everything really is just, it's appalling. It's appalling.
Dan, you've lived in Australia, haven't you?
And, yeah. And
we don't regard Australia as being kind of highly politicised or something in this way that things like this happen. It's viewed as a country where people are pragmatic and just kind of get on with things. This is a strange one, isn't it?
Yeah, you know the Australian phrase, she'd be right, mate. You know, sort of very casual, very sort of easygoing. And you have to remember how iconic the beach is for Australians.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing like it in Ireland. Like we don't, the beach is somewhere we might go occasionally in summer. But for Australians, like for 4 or 5, 6 months of the year, the beach is where they spend their time. They barbecue there. They spend whole days there. You know, they have sports on the beach and surfing and all that. So the beach is absolutely crucial to the Australian way of life. So And of course, Bondi Beach is the most iconic beach in Australia. I'm more familiar with Western Australia. My wife is from Perth, Western Australia. I've spent many, many Christmases there over the years. So this is an attack on the Australian way of life. And Australians have been fortunate to be able to create a society. Like my wife is of Irish and Scottish descent, but she wasn't really conscious of that because in her generation in Australia, they didn't think of themselves as anything other than they were Aussies and that was it.
Yeah.
And the beach was part of their identity. And so this is an attack on the Australian way of life.
But it does seem like it is an anti-Semitic attack as well, doesn't
it?
Yeah,
and that's, I think, I mean, I was speaking to somebody from the Jewish community in Britain during the week who told me that, you know, that his sons are planning to leave Britain. They're planning to move to Israel because they don't feel safe in Britain. He lives close enough to the Manchester synagogue, which was attacked recently. So I think we do have to be careful. I mean, I'm obviously sympathetic to, you know, the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza. But I do think this is an illustration of how we need to be particularly careful about our rhetoric when it comes to Gaza in order to ensure that whenever we make a criticism of Israeli policy in Gaza, that we also make it clear that this is not the responsibility in any way of the Jewish community anywhere in the world.
Yeah, there's a statement from the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Helen McEntee. She says, I want to express my shock and horror at the anti-Semitic attack on a Jewish community celebrating the first day of Hanukkah, which took place at Bondi Beach in Sydney over recent hours. All my thoughts are with the victims and their loved ones and the people of Australia. At this point, we are not aware of any Irish citizens who have been impacted directly by these awful events. Our consulate in Sydney is continuing to monitor events and will remain in close contact with Irish citizens and the community locally. Luke.
It's horrendous, but this has been done on purpose to cause maximum fear, maximum terror. I mean, here's people celebrating Hanukkah at the beach, gunmen appear, start shooting people. It's the most horrendous thing. And I've got friends in Australia. I've got Jewish friends who would celebrate Hanukkah and look what's happened. So it's absolutely horrendous, obviously. And there'll be fear now. And I think, as someone said there, we need to stretch out our arms now and help our Australian friends and make sure they have our support in this horrendous time. I was in Australia last year for Christmas myself. I was in Melbourne, not Sydney. Went to the beach on Christmas Day. Loads of Irish people there, dressed up in Santa costumes and all sorts of things. Can you imagine a gun in that situation shooting people? It's just unspeakable.
Yeah, yeah. And we're not to take away in any way from the fact that this was an attack on Jewish people now, it seems. But it does feel, everyone is saying it, it's reflected in what everyone has said, it feels close to home for us in a way that something on the other side of the world probably wouldn't a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, all of these places where the Irish diaspora is so strong, we obviously have extra ties to countries that are maybe further away geographically, such as Australia, America, Canada, but we feel so close to them because of those familial ties that we have. But having said that, we're things like terrorist attacks and targeted attacks and mass shootings, they're something that we tend to associate with America, but to have it somewhere like Australia that is so close to home for us, and just thinking of the Jewish community in Ireland as well, kind of coming off the back of the Herzog Park and the other week, it really kind of has me stopping and thinking, how far could this go? Anywhere else, we really need to stop and ask ourselves, how do we view Jewish people? What do we think of the role that they play in Ireland? How do we make sure that debacles over what we call a park is as bad as it gets? And I'm actually worried, if I were, I wouldn't like to be a Jew in Ireland right now. I wouldn't like to be Jewish in many Western countries, I have to say. And I can't even imagine how it must feel to have your community attacked in such a specific, targeted way, families, children, somewhere like the beach. It's unbelievable.
And this clearly, listening to Melissa McKay earlier, this was not something that built up gradually. There seems to have been low-level kind of stuff like graffiti and everything, and then something like this happens too. Okay, we'll take a break. We will keep bringing you updates from Bondi throughout the programme, but Dr. Merle Lynch, Professor Luke O'Neill, Alison O'Connor and Dan Mulhall staying with us, and we'll come back with a look at today's papers. Welcome back. Our panel are still with us, Dr. Merle Lynch, Professor Luke O'Neill, Alison O'Connor and Dan Mulhall. We'll take a look at the front pages of today's papers now. The Sunday Independent is leading with hospitals full due to record flu outbreak, but specifically the CHRI is experiencing, that's Children's Health Ireland, an unprecedented surge in flu cases. This is the first time it has hit us this badly, the clinical director of CHRI is saying, and they are looking at creating surge beds there. The Sunday Times is leading with Taoiseach sets new focus on national security, protecting Ireland's energy supply and critical undersea infrastructure from third parties is regarded as a core national priority, he's saying. The Business Post are saying that the Land Development Agency is in discussions to borrow up to $1 billion from the European Investment Bank as it looks to significantly ramp up the delivery of new homes. The Land Development Agency was slow to get going with building homes, but there does seem to be a hope now that they're ramped up and in operation, they will start churning out homes. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with Martin's top advisor told of Gavin Rent before FF vote, and they say Chambers also learned by text the day before the party selected candidate. That story not as simple as it seems, we'll come back to it. The Sun is leading with Johnny Smacks of the Two Johnnies, who is hailing his little fighter. He's opened up about his newborn son's serious health condition, and we wish him and his family all the best. And the Sunday World is headline is Santa Fraud is Coming to Town. Rogue solicitor Michael Lynn, who stole $18 million from clients, dresses up as Father Christmas to go carol singing for a homeless charity. He was out on day release and he was carol singing in a shopping centre. Now, Luke, hospitals full due to record flu outbreak on the front of the Sunday Indo. Yeah. Is this scaremongering? Is it COVID triggering? Or you were writing today, we might have a rough ride ahead. Is this worse than usual, yeah?
It's a mix of things, isn't it, Brendan? No doubt there's a nasty flu going around. Let's start with that. The headline this morning, again, a headline about infectious diseases. Who would have thought it, you know? And but the good news is the vaccine works. There's a great vaccine out there. It gives massive protection. So the question now becomes, how do we get more people people to get vaccinated. What's very important is it takes about a week for the vaccine to kick in. If you're planning on a big Christmas, get the vaccine quick. If you're in these high-risk groups,
obviously. We've been told 2 weeks, but it starts working after.
About a week, it begins. Maximum at two. But you see some benefits after a week
so
or so.
So still not,
you
know, too late.
Not too late. And remember, it's only the high-risk groups we're interested in here, the over-60s children. I mean, this virus, unlike COVID, remember, it didn't affect children really. Yeah. We got lucky with COVID. It didn't really affect children. This one does harm under-5s. So again, get them vaccinated as well. There's a nasal vaccine for them. No need to worry about an injection. Kids prefer nasal than injections, obviously. So there's a vaccine available that really protects really well against this. So, and we always say it's a preventable disease.
Are you concerned that we didn't buy the slightly more expensive enhanced vaccine that I think was specifically tailored to, I think it mutated, did it, since the vaccine was made?
That's right.
But there was a newer vaccine.
It's not
made.
So much that there is an enhanced vaccine out there that's a bit better, 20% better than the current one, right? But it's 3 times as pricey. So there's an issue there. Should we get that one or not? Half the countries in Europe do what we do. We're not getting anything unusual here. And I think at the moment, the current vaccine is fine, 70% protection anyway, you know? So no, I don't think we should worry too much about not having the enhanced one. And the one that's there is fine, really. You know?
Okay. I'll just stay with Luke for a minute because you picked Eilish O'Hanlon's piece in the Sunday Indo. It's deja flu. No one can be surprised by viruses' return or chaotic response. On the vaccines, like, she is saying that, was there a breach of trust in some way between people and governments over vaccines, that they're possibly less than fully honest with us about that there were bad effects for a not insignificant number of people, and that was kind of like sidelined a lot.
I wouldn't exactly say that. People are sick of hearing about this kind of thing. She calls it a national dose of long COVID, which is a good way to put it. When anybody hears about infections, many people go, I don't want to hear about that. I won't go to my doctor. I think it's mainly that, yeah. And there's a bit of not trusting government maybe in there as well. But overall, it's people are just not interested. And they keep actually reminding them, you know, the science is there. The science says, take the vaccine and please follow the science as usual is the message. But it's a good piece she writes, man. She's kind of discussing more generally the effects of COVID but are still with us psychologically is the point she's making, and we'd all agree with that, I think.
Yeah, I think even people hearing talk about masks and everything else,
I think
old people in particular are probably, Alison, do you not think, are feeling a bit scared at the moment and are likely to start isolating themselves a bit over Christmas?
Yes, and I could, you know, and I suppose it's because we saw the headline of Sunday Independent, we've heard what Luke has just said, that it is the reality that there, you know, there's a very bad flu there and more people are getting it. I understand the COVID context and all of that. But I remember a number of years ago reading Alistair Campbell, who was once Tony Blair's spin doctor, who has suffered very badly from his mental health, spoke at a lunch for the pharmaceutical industry. And he stood up and he said, I know the pharmaceutical industry gets a really bad rep, but where would somebody like me be without, in terms of the medication that he takes every day? I'm like that with the vaccines, like early and often. Shoot them into me.
Yeah.
I went a few weeks ago. I got the flu vaccine. I got the COVID vaccine. The rest of the family. I think I hadn't seen this before in that my daughter's in transition year. They came in. They all got, they're young enough to get it, the nasal one. I mean, I just think you're like, it's like fighting, you know, fighting with your toenails that you'd say, I'm not going to get the flu vaccine.
I think when if you hit the really young people avoid, with this could wreck your Christmas partying and socialising.
Yeah, yeah.
They kind of,
I read an account yesterday in the London Times of a photographer who got the real flu. And I'll tell you something, you would be racing for your vaccine. This was a young guy, father of a young baby, who was knocked out for 2 weeks, who had temperatures of 40 degrees for like 5 days straight and ended up in A&E. And all for the sake of going in and getting it done. Now, I appreciate some people feel rotten afterwards. I did sometimes after I felt nothing all this time.
Really? I got the two of them in one day and it knocked us.
Yeah, it can. It can.
SH1T out of me for 4 or 5 days. But Luke, you'd say that was a good reaction,
wasn't
it?
Yeah.
Alison
tried
to. Was there an element of man flu, Brendan?
Yeah.
What?
It was excuse
no, I soldiered on. I soldiered on. Marina, all vaxxed in your house?
So the 1-year-old isn't, because the nasal vaccine is only from age 2, I think. I suppose I could have taken her to get a jab, but honestly, I've got enough going on. But I think one of the interesting pieces, I was kind of interested to hear Luke, you say that we got lucky with COVID. I'm like, good God, if that was us getting lucky, I don't know what, I really don't want to know what an unlucky virus would look like. But the the behavioural team in the ESRI did a lot of research at the time of COVID. And one of the interesting things they found was that if you want to, like, people who were kind of vaccine hesitant, it wasn't actually because of kind of scaremongering around side effects and all the rest of it. It was actually they weren't aware of the benefits of the vaccine. And I kind of see, like, a lot of parents in, say, pro-vax circles, and they're understandably very angry at the kind of anti-vax rhetoric they hear. But it actually is fairly rare in Ireland. It seems that, like, it's not so much, oh, we need to combat all of the misinformation. We just need to communicate to people what are the benefits. And that was actually much more effective in getting people to change their minds around whether or not they'd get vaccinated. In my case, I was actually due to get the flu vaccine in work, and kind of ironically, I was sick that day and ended up working from home. So that put a scupper on that. But we do have asthma in our house as well, and these kind of things. It's just a no-brainer for us.
Luke, there's a text here. Can we please get a vaccine mandate on medics and nurses? That would help a lot with the old and vulnerable. Now, this says 73% of them don't get vaccinated. I believe the latest number I've seen is up from 27% of them getting it to 29% of them getting it. That's lower than certainly among over 50s and over 60s. It's much, much lower.
It's disappointing that the healthcare workers aren't turning up for the vaccine, in a sense. The ones who are taking it, though, are inclined to be high risk anyway. They have diabetes and heart disease. They'll go for it, right?
Right.
Now, they think it's partly fatigue, strangely. There was a piece yesterday in the Irish Times about this, and they worry that they might be off work for a day or two with some of the flu-like effects of these. That's maybe one reason. It's complicated, I think. But mercifully, Brendan, just this morning I saw the numbers going off. They are turning up now and taking the vaccine. But the other big thing for me about this is you're getting vaccinated for yourself, but also for your community. The hospitals are under severe pressure. That means other things can't happen in those hospitals. So if you take the vaccine, you're going to protect our healthcare system for other people as well. So I was reminding people, it's not just about you. And COVID was a bit like that, remember. I think the Irish really responded so well to the vaccination campaign, mainly out of a sense of decency, I think, to be honest, to help other people. And if you are anyway reluctant for this vaccine, take it, because you'll make sure you don't end up in hospital, and that will protect the hospital system as well.
Okay, one quick thing, because I want to move on to politics. This is like the olden days. Ask Luke about masks.
Oh, good Lord. Yes.
PTSD.
If you're a high risk, you'd be wise maybe to wear one at the moment. There's a nasty flu out there.
Okay,
if you're going
right
out in public in a big crowd and it's no ventilation, just to protect yourself, wear
okay
a mask. But
so
not
for the rest
healthy
of us,
no,
don't be judgy of people you see with masks.
No, be simple. Maybe they've had a transplant.
The
they've got diabetes. Okay. That's why they're wearing a mask.
Okay. Alison, politics. The front page of the Mail on Sunday, Martin's top advisor told of Gavin Rent before FF vote. Now, this is going to all kick off next week, as far as we know, isn't it?
Yes, it is, in terms of this report into Jim Gavin being chosen as the Fianna Fáil presidential candidate. You get the sense that the Mail, it'll be a bah humbug Christmas for the Mail if Micheál Martin is still in situ after the report comes out. And as I understand it, actually, Micheál Martin's top advisor, Deirdre Galán, is saying she did not. This story that she knew, that she was sent a text on, is it, I think, September 5th. That was not actually the situation, and it actually goes on.
It was a speculative, non-specific.
Yes, exactly. And the story actually, even inside, goes on to say that the inquiry team were also told the information in the text, though relating to unpaid monies to a tenant, turned out to be slightly erroneous, as it referred to an unpaid deposit. And obviously, an unpaid deposit is a very different thing, because, as we all know from our days of renting, a deposit, and whether you get it back, and whether you consider what sort of shape you as the tenant consider the place to be in and the landlord considers it to be in, are two very different things. So I'm not seeing that much new in those terms. It's obviously a big week for Micheál Martin. It certainly is. I think that politically he's played it well to kick it this far down the road. I'd say maybe the public are feeling a bit weary from it at this stage. Jennifer Bray and Claire Scott have a piece in the front of the Sunday Times saying that Fianna Fáil bosses blew 400,000 on the Oras bid. And I think that too is something that's really important to the organisation and to the party. The idea that somebody who pulled out of the race that didn't even have a candidate, although his name was on the ballot, that that much money was spent is very significant.
Okay, but I'd say you're calling it for Micheál Martin to make Christmas and into the new year.
And the evidence of what I'm seeing is in the report. Yes, he's been significantly damaged, without a doubt.
Dan, do you think he's all right?
I think so. I know Deirdre Galán because I worked with her when Micheál Martin was Minister of Foreign Affairs. And as you probably know, civil servants and advisors don't always gel very well. But Deirdre Galán is, I'd say, universally popular, you know, and seen as a very capable person and very reliable to deal with. So I'd like to hear Deirdre's version of the story, frankly. But I think that damage has been done, obviously. But I would be very surprised if there was an early move against Micheál Martin. I think it might come sometime down the road, but I don't see it happening in the immediate term.
Okay, well, we'll see that play out next week. There's a lot, Myrne, across the papers today about security in various forms. So you were looking at John Mooney on the front of the Sunday Times. Taoiseach sets new focus on national security. And this is security in its broadest terms as well, energy security, which would be one of your specialities.
Yeah, so I often like to distinguish between what we call physical security and price security, which people kind of mix up a lot of the time.
Okay, go on, yeah.
So kind of price security is what price are we paying for our energy? So if kind of there's not much good having petrol available at the pump or having gas available if it's too expensive for most people to be able to
afford
it.
And are we paying too much in Ireland compared to other countries?
We are paying a high price, certainly, for electricity.
Do we know why?
Kind of. we can't know exactly why without kind of seeing all of the data that all of the energy companies have, and they're just not going to give that to us. But there are certain things that we do know, like we use more gas for our electricity generation than any other country in Europe. We have an awful lot of dispersed housing. That means we need more wires to move electricity around the place. Then we're also kind of at the end of a gas pipeline. And then I think another thing that I want to dig more into the data on this, but we've now seen how vulnerable we are to energy shocks, which I think means that energy companies here are pricing in an extra risk premium that other European countries don't have to do because they have access to things like LNG. They have access to kind of sources of
Where's our vulnerability supply wise then?
So we're incredibly vulnerable when it comes to gas. We have Corrib, which is less than half our demand now and is going to be depleted soon enough. And after Corrib, every single molecule of gas burnt on this island comes through one double pipeline from Scotland to Derry. That's it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. We have no facility for importing gas any other way. Now,
we have to keep on good terms with the Scottish as well, yeah?
Now, there are an awful lot of international agreements behind that. You're not able to just unilaterally cut off supply without triggering all sorts of treaties and that kind of thing. But where we are very vulnerable is... the thing, like to an attack. Like that is, it's a double pipeline. So it's not like you just blow up one pipeline. You need to blow up the two.
Okay.
But still, it's incredibly vulnerable. And we know that there are scoping exercises being done by the Russian military to see where are the vulnerabilities, not just to our gas, but also to our communications infrastructure. And there's a kind of an idea that, what the story is focusing on here is the LNG terminal, which is liquefied natural gas. So what that basically means is gas obviously is a gas, but if you put it under extreme pressure, you can turn it into a liquid. And then it's far more flexible. You can do what you do with oil, which is you can put it into a barrel, you can put it into a tank, you can sail it around
but
the world.
Does it keep for long as a reserve? If we have a reserve of LNG there, as a backup, do they see something that you can't keep that reserve there indefinitely? It naturally atrophies or something?
That's kind of two separate questions. One is gas storage. We don't have any storage on the island either. So we don't, you can
But even if we get it, how watertight is it?
Well, it's more that the terminal itself would allow you to import gas on a ship.
Yeah.
So you're not dependent on a gas pipeline. it means that even if something happened to the pipeline or if the price of gas goes crazy, you can still import gas via a ship from anywhere in the world that has an export facility. And there's only, to the best of my knowledge, there is exactly one piece of academic research done on the impact of an LNG terminal for Ireland. It was done by a researcher who's now in UCD and another one who's in Paris. They were in the ESRI at the time. And it finds that an LNG terminal would have a positive impact on security and on price.
And as an expert, would you say it's a no-brainer for us to have that backup?
I would say that it is simply a fact that having gas storage and having an LNG facility would improve our energy security.
Okay, so that's not an ideological point of view.
Exactly. Anyone who denies that fact is just not at the races. Now, if you want to say that that boost in security is not worth X, Y, Z, climate consideration, that's fine. You can make that argument. But what you cannot say is that an LNG facility would not improve our energy security, because it unequivocally would.
Okay. Dan, on the broader security issue, you picked Leo Varadkar as a good piece in the Sunday Times. Being neutral does not mean being weak.
Yeah, I mean, I've been following this debate carefully and trying to contribute to it a little bit on social media. Neutrality is a means to an end. And the end is your security. You want to be secure. And we have chosen over the last 80 years to not join the military alliance on the basis that that would be the best way of keeping Ireland secure. It obviously kept us secure during the Second World War, where we weren't bombed very much, one incident only. But the world has changed. And look, Russian troops are never going to land on Banner Strand or in Tramore, County Waterford, where I come from. But warfare has changed. Imagine what a few military drones would do around Dublin Airport. Could close the airport for days, could cut us off effectively from the rest of the world, right? Look at what could happen if we were subjected to a serious military-grade cyber attack. It could close down all sorts of elements of our national life.
Okay, people before profit will say you are scaremongering in order to get us to join the military-industrial complex.
First of all, we're not... There's no military alliance for us to join. NATO probably wouldn't allow us in because we spend so little on defence that they would regard us as a liability and not any asset, right? There is no military alliance in Europe to join. The problem is, if we're attacked, do we just say we have no defence, we do nothing, we just sit there and hope that enemies of Ireland or of Europe will just spare us because we're nice people? That won't happen. Look at the amount of technology that's currently based in Ireland, that's connected with the rest of the Atlantic community, America and the European Union. If you were a person with a malign agenda towards Europe, you might see Ireland as a weak link. There was a piece in the Financial Times there recently saying, is Ireland the weak link in European defence? So I think it makes 100% sense for us to at least step up our spending to some degree. I'm not saying we're ever going to get to the 2% or the 3.5% that NATO has now have as a target. But, for example, Austria spends 1% of its GDP on defence. New Zealand spends 1% of its GDP on defence. New Zealand is probably more secure than we are. It's further away from tension points in the world. So I think a move towards 1%, it wouldn't make us warmongers. But it would at least mean that we would be able to find out what's in our skies and what's in our seas.
Okay, yeah. And it probably still wouldn't realistically give us enough to defend ourselves if worse came to worse.
At least we would
Alison,
know where the threats are coming
you're
from.
Writing about this yourself today, and you've also picked a couple of pieces in the Business Post.
Yeah, there's a very good editorial in the Business Post on it, actually, and a piece by Daniel Murray. I wonder, will we look back on this time in the future and think, what the hell were we at? You know, it's almost like you want to grab everyone by the collar and a good shake and say, look around, look at what's happening. Yes, we are on the edge of Europe, but that also means actually we're the western flank of the European Union, out here all on our own. And we just don't seem to be. You try and have a discussion about it and you're immediately thrown in with people throwing back, like you mentioned people before, you know, this whole military industrial complex thing. And this very immature debate or fretting about the triple lock, which to me is an absolute nonsense. I'm writing this week about where are the opposition party leaders in all of this. What happened with Zelensky's plane was very significant. It was raised in the Dáil during the week, and we say, for instance, with Sinn Féin by Rose Conway Walsh. I want to know, what do Mary Lou MacDonald, Ivana Bacik, Holly Cairns, Where do they stand? How are they calling the government to account? Of course, they don't really want to get into it because it doesn't necessarily fit with the whole triple lock thing.
I noticed, Alison, that when the $1.7 billion defence plan was announced, Sinn Féin's main complaint seemed to be these are things that were announced already, which I usually think is Sinn Féin's way of saying we're not going to disagree with this hugely, but this is our way of...
Yeah, and not actually addressing it. I mean, when you look at what happened this week, Mark Rutte of NATO saying that within 5 years, Russia might be ready to attack Europe. You saw what happened in the States with the Trump administration, this new strategy saying that they'd no longer guarantee Europe's security and that Europe was weak, decaying. So essentially, we are the meat and the sandwich between... We can no longer rely on America as an ally and we have Russia on the other side. Yeah. And we have the rest of Europe very sensibly deciding that they need to arm up. And there's some very interesting, on the military stuff, there's some very interesting, the economics of it. Martin Wall in the Irish Times had a story yesterday talking about how Pascal Donoghue vetoed defence wanting to borrow up to 100 million for military equipment. This is this loan
from the Rearm Europe.
Exactly. Yeah. And also that...
But Simon Harris was...
He was the Minister for Defence. Then at the end of May, the Secretary General of the Department of the Taoiseach wrote to Department of Public Expenditure highlighting that a step changing in funding was urgently required. So we do now have the situation where Simon Harris moved from defence into finance, will hopefully lobby himself. And we will. and that will happen. And one final thing that the Business Post mentions is that there's 800 billion available for the Rearm EU plan, right? But we don't allow our companies to, it's all this thing based on neutrality. So even if you had some incredibly bright entrepreneur in Ireland who had some amazing way of countering drones or what happened with Zelensky.
Now, they seem to be moving on that. Yeah.
And my last piece then is Cathal Berry, the former TD, is really good on this. In the Examiner yesterday, he was making the point that the weapons on board the WB-8s, which was out in Dublin Bay, are over 50 years old, second hand, and that actually the crew, the Navy crew that were on board, it was their eyeballs that they used to see the drones because they don't have any equipment.
Laughable. The drones deliberately had their lights on as well, I think. Yeah. Luke, there's a great piece in the Business Post. I don't know enough to know if he's right or wrong, but Bobby Healy from Mana is saying, where is it here? But he's saying basically that we're great at aviation in this country and we're great at technology, that we should be getting in on making non-lethal drones, etc.
Definitely. I mean, what gets me about this is a very depressing conversation. There's a finite budget in Ireland and in the EU, and we're talking about building an army here instead of funding health and education. You know, that's the depressing part of this. But on the more positive side, if you invest in science, you may get good weapons out of it that may defend us, first of all. And he's talking about defence really here, you know, different technologies that might defend us. And what gets me is the rate of discovery in this area is massive. Every war brings new technologies. Like World War II brought radar, for instance. This drone technology is getting more and more elaborate. Ireland...
Driven by the Ukrainians, a lot of it.
But that's what drives the war. It's the usual thing. Necessity is the mother of invention here. Yeah. You know, we could have a great industry in Ireland to defend us with high-tech drones that are very elaborate. You know, and these drones could be used for many things. Medical supply delivery is one. Like in Africa, for example, you can now deliver medicines into remote parts with drones where people can't get in. You know, there's all kinds of applications here that are for the good of humanity, as well as defending us.
If there's a drone, or if there are drones invading our airspace, we should have a way of A, finding out where they are, identifying what they are, and then taking them out in some way, or at least dealing with them. Yeah. And the idea that we can't do that because of a taboo about neutrality seems to me to be totally facile.
I'm not sure about everyone else here, but I wonder about this idea that when we have the EU presidency the second half of next year, we will have 50 EU leaders. And you really have to worry and wonder whether we have the capability to mind them. That's a lot of moving targets.
I believe we will be dependent on the kindness of strangers, as the lady said. Okay, we'll take a break. Muireann Lynch, Luke O'Neill, Alison O'Connor and Dan Mulhall staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel's still with us. Muireann Lynch, Luke O'Neill, Alison O'Connor and Dan Mulhall. Luke, you picked Sarah Breen in the Sunday Indo. Let's Follow Australia on social media.
Yep, very hot topic, man, isn't it, at the moment? You know, yeah. And in the university, I can tell you one thing, far too much social media use is happening and
really?
Causing anxiety and
I
all sorts.
I thought you'd be up for this.
No, we love it. It's as usual, it's got benefits and it's got negatives, hasn't it? You know, but the fact is, young people, as we all know, and all, this is in response to this, mental health problems, anxiety, social media use is scientifically proven to be a part of that. So the Australians have responded.
Well, there's a correlation between the massive rise in anxiety and mental health issues and the arrival of the phones into their lives.
Yeah, there can be a risk of causation correlation here, perhaps, you know.
Yeah. But have you seen it in you've seen the generation presumably before the phones came along, and you've seen them since the phones came along, the crowd who grew up on the phones then. Can you see the difference, yeah?
Absolutely. And the number of students going to counselling skyrocketed. I was in Canada 2 weeks ago giving lectures in Vancouver, and the head of the medical faculty told me half the medical students are on some kind of medication for anxiety. Now, that's over-prescription partly, of course, is the number of reasons.
Medical students used to just drink themselves stupid.
Well,
that was
the good old days. Yeah, the good old days.
Now
they're on SSRIs. And I asked her, well, what do you make of this? We don't really know. I mean, it's multifactorial as ever. But the thing is, there's an element. If you're under 16 and you're on social media, that's not necessarily great. And the Australians have now made a move on this. So I'm in favour of certainly the under 16s. What you really want is education, of course, to because it won't go away. There are ways around it, you know?
Yeah.
So we've got to help
train. And they need
train,
to be able to deal with all this.
Yeah, they'll deal
as well,
with it. Yeah, that's the real answer, ultimately, is not to ban it, because that never really works in the long run anyway, you know?
Yeah.
But ultimately, we've got to educate young people how to deal with this world that we're living in. But it's all about misinformation, all those sorts of issues that we all know about, you know? But it's
we're in a ban. Is imperfect, like, and it actually a lot of people are very critical of it and everything. But do you think it's one answer?
Yeah, I do. I've been following the data on this kind of relatively closely, considering it's not my area, and it's you'll never get the gold standard of a kind of a natural experiment here. You're only ever going to be working with correlations after the fact,
because we don't have a control group.
Exactly, no control group. Basically. You can't now. There are some studies that kind of get people to sort of opt into giving up social media for a certain time, and you have kind of a control group there, and the results from those aren't super conclusive, but you kind of have to look at the counterfactual. And if the counterfactual here is, would it be the worst thing in the world if we didn't have social media? And it's hard to see like unbelievable, unintended downsides to getting rid of social media. And certainly when you kind of talk to kids, and when I talk to my own nieces and nephews and stuff, and you say, do you like that TikTok exists? Would you like TikTok to be gone? They tend to say yes. But then you say, given that TikTok is there, would you like to leave TikTok yourself? And they say no. And it's the same for all of the socials, because it's essentially, it's what we call a kind of a tragedy of the commons or a collective action problem, which is as long as anyone's on it, everyone needs to be on it. Whereas if no one was on it, no one would need to be on it. There are obviously problems with a ban, though, in a European context, and that it's not something we can do on our own. We'd have to do it as part of the EU because of different EU competencies. And it doesn't seem to be super high on the list of priorities. Sometimes I wonder if that's because this teen mental health crisis, it is worldwide, but it seems to be particularly acute in
English-speaking
exactly. So, like, is it the case that Germany, France, they're just not seeing it to the same extent as us?
Alison, Dan first.
I've remained on X, even though it's become more and more toxic and there's so much abuse there. I've stayed on because I feel an obligation to put out a sort of a middle-of-the-road point of view, a point of view based on my own experience and knowledge, because I know there are a lot of people there who don't get involved. They never respond to me, but they're reading my stuff and I feel I'm doing something to try
and counter. If we leave the pitch to the extremes,
look, I saw this in America where a lot of the stuff that's not mainstream started on social media and it took over. Because, look, decent people, if they read stuff again and again and again, they may believe it. Like people believed what they read in the papers in my childhood. My parents believed everything in the papers. And there's a danger that at least the papers were written in those days by people who had a professional obligation to be in balance in some way.
Papers still are.
Yeah, but now you have people online who are just promoting all kinds of stuff. I mean, when Zelensky was here, I noticed about 90% of the stuff I saw on Twitter from supposedly Irish accounts were incredibly negative about Ukraine and incredibly positive about Russia. So that's the kind of world. Whereas In the general population, it's probably 90-10 the other direction, maybe even more. So the point is, it's not representative. But the danger is that if you leave it there, it'll just take root and people will start to believe some of the nonsense that's been perpetrated by people who obviously have a malign agenda.
Yeah. Alison, going back to the point that Murren was making there, it is a difficult one for parents because on one hand, nobody wants their child to be the hicky one who doesn't have the phone, who's not connected to the friends. If it's all going on Snapchat and everything, which Snapchat's had plenty toxicity of its own. But if that's where the other kids are at, it's hard to tell your kid, well, you can't be there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still, I suppose, in an active parenting phase. But I already think that when I look back, that this will be a really major regret of parenting.
Yeah.
The social media thing, the phone addiction. I'm addicted to my phone myself.
It's right there.
Yeah, exactly. And right in front of me. And Sarah Breen is saying, because she has a child that is coming up to that primary, you know, secondary school and that whole thing, of which is what we did. You'll get a phone, you know, before you start in first year. And now she's saying that she's going to tell, I think it's her daughter, that actually, no, we've changed our mind. And that's a really difficult thing to do if, like, as Murray's just, if every other child has it. And it is like this, it is like this kind of contagion where you think you can't do that to your child. And yet, and even as I say this now, and yet you're feeling that it does do an awful lot of damage.
Yeah.
And I know that...
We all know at some visceral level this is madness.
Ourselves. It's absolute madness. Now, Patrick O'Donovan, who's the minister responsible in this area, is hoping to raise it as an issue during the EU presidency. And has mentioned, you know, the fact that because it's the rules are made at an EU level that we're hamstrung to an extent, and there's an app being worked on, where so it's this idea that you would have to give some form of ID to show that you're over 18 or whatever, or over whatever age is stipulated. You mightn't want to give your PPS number to Meta or whatever, that it, so it would go through some state. I know there's some people wouldn't want to do it to the state either. So is it perfect what Australia is doing or any of the proposals? Not at all. You get your VPN, you know, my God, if there's one thing the teenagers will be doing, it's getting ahead of it. But I am delighted that something is happening and that there is some movement and that
it might give some support to parents.
It will give some support to parents.
Because when we Jonathan Hayton, that's what he was saying. Yeah. Any way that the collective can help the individual is. Murren, you picked a piece in the Business Post by Anton Savage. Tender office phobic Gen Z need to toughen up or feel the sharp edge of AI.
Yeah, I tend to get kind of triggered by any piece that's going on about how namby-pamby Gen Z are. But I think just on the broader question of this constant, should we do hybrid work or not? Should we make people go into the office or not? I just feel like everything, can we not just give managers discretion? Can we not just give people discretion and say, if your employee is doing great work at home, let them at it. If they're not doing great work at home, it'll be better in the office, bring them in. But the problem is, it's like...
Would it not toughen up the old Gen Zs to bring them in and make them deal with people face to face and answer the phone and all that kind of thing? That's the point.
I'm sure, I might do that for some of them, but he's at pains to point out it's roughly 20%. So what about the other 80% who are doing just fine, who have these incredibly long commutes because they can't buy property where the likes of Anton Savage's peers and older might have been able to afford to do
so. We don't know where does Anton Savage have property.
It is incredibly difficult to hire right now because we are offering not great salaries in an incredibly expensive city to live in. So the fact that we can offer remote working is a huge bonus.
And let us not forget that Gen X, when we were their age, were bloody useless as well. Like,
it
took us years to get going and become the sensible people we are now.
It's the tale as old as time. And
speaking of Gen X, Luke, you've 30 seconds because you want to mark the fact that Pulp have been made Album of the Year in the Sunday
very,
Times.
Very, very important. This is the good news story from this. Yes, the Jarvis Cocker Pulp have Album of the Year. Isn't that amazing? The Sunday Times. They hadn't released an album in 24 years. Big gaff, you know?
Yeah.
Great album. I've listened to it a lot and it's a fantastic piece of music. And of course, Jarvis, as you may remember with Common People, there's a great lyric in one of his songs. He says, "So you move from Camden to Hackney and you worry about now wrinkles instead of acne." And that captures it.
That's the cycle of life right there. That's everything we've been talking about. Thanks very much to my excellent panel this morning, Dr. Murren Lynch, Professor Luke O'Neill, Alison O'Connor and Dan Mulhall.